Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. Days, hedonism strikes a beat in society. We have long been told that if it feels good, if it is what we want, so long as we aren't hurting others, then we should do it. But does that kind of self-indulgence really lead to a successful and satisfying life? My guest on this episode of Humanize, Dr. Andrew Villabella, doesn't think so. To avoid dysfunction and lead a truly happy and satisfying life, Dr. Abella suggests developing and practicing what he calls super habits that can aid us all in making wise decisions, managing emotions, and interacting with other people. In fact, he has written a book to explain it all, Super Habits, the Universal System for a Successful Life. Andrew Abella is the founding dean of the Bush School of Business and ordinary professor of marketing at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. He is a faculty affiliate at the Harvard University Human Flourishing Program and a contributor at Forbes.com. His research on the integrity of the marketing process, including marketing ethics, Catholic social doctrine, and internal communication, has been published in several academic journals. He is the winner of the 2009 Novak Award, a $10,000 prize given by the Acton Institute for significant contributions to the study of the relationship between religion and economic liberty. He is also the author of A Catechism for Business from Catholic University Press. Dr. Abella holds an MBA from the Institute of Management and Development in Switzerland and a PhD from the Darden Business School at the University of Virginia. Prior to his academic career, he worked in the private sector as a brand manager for Procter & Gamble, a management consultant with McKinsey & Company, and managing director of the corporate executive board. He and his wife, Kathleen, live in Falls Church, Virginia, and have six children and one grandchild. Andrew, welcome to Humanize.
Good to be here.
Your career has been both in the private sector and in academia, involving with marketing and management. What got you interested in those pursuits?
Many years ago, as an undergraduate, I read a book. You've heard of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. The edition, yes. I had a postscript written by Huxley, where he said that the future is going to be in the hands of those who are able to manipulate the minds of others, the persuaders. And I was young and ambitious, and I thought, well, if there's going to be any persuading, I want to be the one doing it. So I decided to go into marketing. It was not the most noble of motives, but it was a good education, and it certainly helps me understand a lot about the way the world works.
What was some of the work you did in the private sector?
So I started with Procter & Gamble. I'd been told, and I believe it still, that working there was like getting a master's degree in marketing. It's a terrific education that you got. Because at a young age, I was one point their youngest brand manager worldwide. So I think I was 23 years old and had a multi-million dollar business, which back in the 80s was $1 million was a lot of money, you know. So I got a lot of experience actually running a business at a very early age, but also working within a large corporation. So that was fascinating. And then after that, I worked for McKinsey & Company, and this was in the early to mid 1990s. So I worked in Argentina when they were going through one of their many different sort of economic upheavals and sort of opening up of the economy. Worked in Russia for a while after the fall of the Soviet Union, trying to help bring capitalism to Russia. Didn't go so great, but it was actually one of the people we're working with got assassinated while I was there. So that was rather chilling, you know.
Yes.
It was a good all around fascinating experience of the business world, but showed me also some of the darker sides. I noticed I kept gravitating towards any kind of employee formation, development, and so on. I'd offer a volunteer. I was a regular faculty for McKinsey and Company for their training for new consultants, for example. We used to meet at different parts of the world to onboard new consultants. I always used to volunteer for that. At a certain point, realized, you know what, I'd like to spend the rest of my life in higher education. So I went off and got a PhD, and I've been in academia ever since.
So you switched to academia because you wanted to help people learn to do what you had been doing?
Well, to do it better, I should say. what happened, here's a key point, is in my, I was about 25 when I had a reversion experience. I was baptized, raised Catholic, but fell away from any kind of religious practice in my early teens. But around 25, after kind of some years of searching for the meaning of life, realized that it had been in front of me all along. And so I returned to the Catholic Church and then started to question kind of what's the implications of my Catholic beliefs, my newly rediscovered Catholic beliefs, Christian beliefs. What are their implications for the world of work, the world of business? And so I was at McKinsey as a practicing Christian and kind of just looking, raising all kinds of questions. The last assignment I was given at McKinsey was to lay off 10,000 middle managers of a large bank. And I don't think layoffs are in any way immoral, but in my case, this is more of an emotional reaction. My dad, who had been a senior manager at a bank, had been laid off the year before, in his mid-50s, without much prospect of ever getting another banking job. There was a recession at the time. He did all right. He moved into the sort of not-for-profit sector, and then after that has had a long career as an artist, which is fantastic. But just the idea of seeing the kind of what he had gone through and then thinking, I'm about to do that 10,000 times, you know, just made me really want to understand kind of what does it mean to be a faithful Christian in business? And where could I go to ask that question and kind of research it? And then, so I decided on academia would be good. My doctorate is in business ethics. And then 12 years ago, I had the privilege to start an actual business school focused exactly on that question, you know? So it's been an interesting path, yeah.
There are a lot of people who might say business ethics is an oxymoron. How do you respond to that?
Believe me, I've heard all the jokes. Your dissertation must be the shortest one ever, you know, that sort of thing. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. And in fact, business at its best, I now can say with great certainty, is business when it's done for others, you know, from a moral perspective. That's the kind of longer lasting successful businesses that flourish are usually led by people who are concerned by something other than just profitability. You have to have profitability, otherwise you're not a business, you know, and you have to have market level profitability, otherwise you won't have any shareholders, you know. But all of that said, those are results, kind of important results, but they're not goals. You can't set them as goals because then you do worse. Ironically, when you set profitability to be your goal, you're less profitable than somebody else who sets innovation or service to be their goal. And we know this just from many kind of case examples, research, and so on.
That's very interesting and would be an interesting subject for a different conversation, because you're saying basically that by being virtuous, that leads to profits, as opposed to putting profits first, which might make you less virtuous.
Right. Yeah, it's a good way of putting it. In the short term, if you put profits first, you'll get more profits. But over the longer term, you end up weakening the business. Because the surest way to make lots of money in the short term is to cheat people, not invest, you know, that you maximize your short-term returns, but you'll minimize the longer-term returns doing that.
What is the role of the Bush School of Business at Catholic University, and what kinds of courses are taught there?
So we founded the school to kind of research and teach kind of how to be a faithful Christian in business. What does that mean? And so what we do is we teach all of the disciplines you would expect, you know, finance, marketing, accounting, and so on. But in every case, we teach them from the perspective of a person of faith. So that even though some of the textbooks we use would be the same textbooks you use elsewhere, the conversations can be very different because we're helping students understand that, in a sense, by serving others, kind of their success in business is going to come through from an orientation of service to others.
You know, writing a nonfiction book, which I've done quite a few times myself, takes a tremendous amount of effort and research. What were the reasons you believe that a book on super habits was needed, particularly since you already have a lot of work to do without authoring a book?
Yes. Yes, it was a lot of work, but it was very rewarding. The reason I wrote the book, so the word super habits, as you know, is my word for virtues. And the reason I use that word is I find too many people, even people well-formed in a religious faith, misunderstand the word virtue. They think of it as a sort of pious exhortation, be virtuous, be good. Whereas the actual technical meaning of the word virtue, a virtue is a habit of excellence. You know, these are originally discovered by the ancient Greeks. They are, in a sense, the secret to a successful and happy life. And there's a lot of people who are in need of a successful and happy life right now. And the word virtue was a turnoff, I think, or a source of misunderstanding. And so, and at the same time, you have books about habits selling in the millions of copies. So I love, for example, Atomic Habits, great book, James Clear. The problem with that book and others like it is they tell you all about how to develop good habits, but they don't tell you which are the good habits. And we know the answer to that.
And that's the role of the book you wrote.
Exactly. I build on the other habits books to say, yes, by all means, build good habits, and these are the ones. And it's not just going to listen to me because I'm somehow smarter. What I did in the book was I consolidated a whole bunch of empirical research, recent empirical research, on which virtue, which, kind of what are the virtues and what are the outcomes of growing in each one of them. So whether it be gratitude or courage or resilience or orderliness or whatever, in every case, as you grow in any one of these, you become happier and in many cases healthier as well. And this is scientific fact.
And this is not a proselytizing book. You're not promoting Catholicism, correct?
No, in fact, there's no reference. Well, there's a small reference to religion because religion is actually one of the 50 virtues that I talk about in the book. But it's written for a general audience. It doesn't presuppose any religious perspective. And I know people have read it. There's an accompanying app with the book. I know people using the app who are atheists and getting benefit from it. So.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about the app at the end of the interview because I went to it. It's very interesting. Is the book for just for people in their professional and work lives, or is it for personal or both?
It's for all of life. I think it has a significant benefit at work, and that was my original intention writing it. But it's relevant for your social life, kind of relationships. It is, at root, it addresses what I call the human operating system. Because the virtues together act like a human operating system. They are the thing that underlies everything that we do successfully. And all of the skills, knowledge we may have all depends on having this underlying group of virtues to activate them. And so every dimension of human life benefits from growing in these virtues. And so hence the book applies to every dimension of human life.
The subtitle aims at helping readers live a, quote, successful life. What do you mean by that? What is a successful life in terms of your understanding?
So by success, I mean human flourishing, which includes kind of social success in terms of having friends, good and deep friendships. It includes business success, you know, having success in your career includes financial success in terms of kind of generating and building wealth and so on. Most of all, it includes what you might call interior success. So becoming the kind of person that you most want to be, that's going to make you kind of the happiest. You know, some people say the best version of yourself, you know, all of the above. Because external success is in many cases contingent upon things, you know, sometimes you get a bad break or two, you know. But there's a sort of internal success that is indifferent to external circumstances that anybody can achieve at any time. It's always a good idea to grow in the virtues because they're going to make you happier than you would be otherwise, regardless of your circumstances.
So the idea isn't to make everyone a CEO or let's say a lawyer, but regardless of what one does for a living, to do that very well, and then also to help your personal life so that you have a well-balanced life. Is that what we're thinking?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. In fact, I mean, more than well-balanced, it's just flourishing on every dimension, you know?
What do you mean by flourishing?
So, it's a very good question because on the one hand, I don't mean there is sort of one way to succeed. And if you do that, you flourish, you know. But on the other hand, I also don't mean the opposite, which is whatever you feel like, you know, follow your bliss. You know what I mean?
Yes.
that there is something about human being. There are certain things we know about what makes human beings happy over the long term. And the virtues are the way to do that. So by flourishing, I guess I would define it as long-term happiness. Not the kind of giddy, like, yay, I'm happy, 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 because something good happened to me moments ago, you know, but this longer enduring peacefulness, kind of underlying joy that even when bad things happen, it's like, okay, bad things happen. I do what I can to overcome them, but they don't ultimately upset my general sort of peace of mind and sense of being in the right place in the universe.
So is this what you would call a self-help book or is it something else?
That's such a good question because I remember one time hearing somebody give a talk kind of denigrating self-help books. And my son was with me. And so then when he saw what I was doing, he said, "Dad, are you writing a self-help book?" But actually, yes, it is. And if I would say deliberately so. And in fact, one of the nicest reviews I got was from a very successful Substack author, N.S. Lyons, is a pseudonym, a terrific guy. And he wrote, "This is a work of philosophy masquerading as a self-help book." And that's kind of what I was aiming for. Everything in the book is rigorously based on the latest and best scientific research, as well as kind of deep traditional philosophy, particularly the philosophy, the work of Thomas Aquinas, the medieval philosopher and theologian Thomas Aquinas. So that you're standing on very solid ground, but I made an effort to write the book to sound, feel like a self-help book. So there's lots of interesting stories from history, contemporary life, just to make it a fun read. I didn't want to write yet another academic book. You know, I've done that before.
Yeah, this is for a popular audience, in other words.
Exactly. I want it to be accessible to even, you know, a high school senior, an early career person, a middle manager, a CEO. I wanted every one of them to be able to read it and go, wow, this is interesting, useful stuff for me.
You write about what you call positive psychology. What is that and why is it important?
So it's a discipline within psychology. It was founded by Dr. Martin Seligman about 30 years ago at the University of Pennsylvania and has flourished tremendously. It was based on a genius insight. What Seligman and his colleagues said was, we in psychology, all we seem to do is study pathology. We study mental illness. Why don't we study mental health for a change and just see what does it look like when somebody is mentally healthy, you know? And so they use the ancient idea of the virtues as a springboard to get them going. Their terminology has shifted a little bit, but basically what they do is they study the virtues. what helps a person grow in virtue, what the outcomes are. And it's just, there's now thousands upon thousands of studies, good quality work, and super, super helpful, I think, in terms of understanding virtue. Because it used to be that we could say virtue, acting virtuously makes you happy, that the happiest people are virtuous people. And we did that on the authority of Aristotle and Aquinas, and we sort of tried to make a logical argument for why that's the case. It's a good logical argument that when your desires are aligned with kind of what you need to do, then obviously you will be happier than otherwise. I can get into that in more detail. But now it's just helpful to have all stacks of empirical research saying, yeah, the more you grow in virtue, the happier you get, and here's the science behind it, you know?
And that's, again, it's not religious, and you're not talking about living a life that is based on the Bible, but it's based on what you said was empirical evidence.
Exactly. And this is done by researchers who have, in many cases, no religious orientation whatsoever. So
let's go back again to what a virtue is. You touched on it earlier, but I'd like to get a little bit deeper into that. As you said, a virtue, sometimes people get turned off because they think, oh, you're trying to preach to me or whatever. But it means more than that, as you just earlier described it. So tell us what a virtue is in a traditional sense, what was meant. And then super habits, are they just virtue by a different name, or is it something a little bit different?
So I'll tell you what virtue is and what it isn't. So virtue is a habit of excellence. It's a habit of excellence that's not just about ethics. It's not just about morality. It's about excellence in every human dimension, every aspect of human life.
You mean attaining excellence, is that right?
About the pursuit of excellence. Yeah, exactly. But it's a habit that leads one towards excellence in a specific dimension of life. So, for example, the virtue of gratitude makes you excellent with respect to being grateful. You know, it makes you a very grateful person. It's not primarily about religion. In fact, traditionally, it's about the natural side of life. There are religious or what are called theological virtues, but my book is focused on the natural virtues. Virtues are different from values. This is really important, I think. And people, again, often confuse the two. I like to distinguish them as follows. Values are talking the talk, whereas virtues are walking the walk. Virtues are values that have become habits, you know, and that's the big difference. Because you can
say that again. Virtues are
values that have become habits.
Okay. And then that begs the question, what do you mean by a habit?
So a habit is what both the philosophers and psychologists call a stable disposition. And we now know neurologically what a habit is in a sense a new or a reinforced pathway in your brain. When you do something repeatedly, you are creating or strengthening a pathway in your brain. And so habits become what we call second nature. They become a routine that you do with less effort, more promptly, and generally, when we're talking about the virtues, more happily. So, for example, if I grow in the virtue of orderliness, I use that as a example a lot because many of our students, that's where they strive to grow in. The virtue of orderliness is the habit of doing one thing after another in kind of an orderly, reasonable sequence. As you grow in the virtue of orderliness, you find it easier to be orderly. You tend to default to being orderly, and you become happier about it. And so the virtues is a really good news story, because whatever somebody may be struggling with in life, as they grow in the appropriate virtue, the struggle is reduced. And it actually becomes easier to do the thing that used to be a struggle for you. You don't just become better at it. It literally feels easier.
So let's say that I'm a person who has a problem with acting erratically, because you were talking about orderliness. And of course, when one acts erratically, you get incredibly different consequences and results of behaviors depending on what occurs, but it may never be, well, why is this thing not working this time when it worked better last time? But because you've acted erratically, you know, you're undermining your own desires. How does one go from being an erratic person as a matter of habit, because that probably is already your habit, to change to become orderly in your the way you live your life?
So the first thing is to, well, actually, there are four stages in the development of a virtue, there's a problem. I mentioned a problem with the word virtue. There are problems with other related words that I'll go into, and you'll see what I mean in one moment. So a virtue, a habit of excellence, is the opposite of that is a vice, right? Which is a habit of not excellence. So the erraticness, for example, that you talk about,
I was going to get into vices. So talk about that.
The word vice nowadays, we think of it as in Miami Vice, Vice Squad, you know, it was just like really bad criminal stuff, you know. But technically, what it means is a bad habit. So virtue is a good habit, habit of excellence. A vice is a bad habit. But you can't just flip from chaos to orderliness. There are intervening steps that you have to work your way through. And classically, the ancients called them, and we translate them to English as incontinence and continence. And you can see
immediately. That's a different perspective today, too.
Very different meaning today. So those words are not very helpful because they have something to do with bladder control. You know? So instead, I use, when I teach this to my students or in businesses, a four-part framework that has been applied to skill development, but I think works for virtues as well, where you begin at the level of what's called unconscious incompetence, where you don't know and don't even care that you don't have this habit of excellence. So if you are chaotic, a chaotic kind of person, you probably think that's just the way I am. I'm a creative person. I don't like to be bound by rules or guidelines or whatever. So I'm just that way. But it's possible that at some point in your life, you realize I'm not achieving what I could be achieving because I'm so kind of just always bouncing around. And maybe you realize, you know, I could use some more order in my life. So let's say you try the simplest little thing. Each day, you're going to write down one thing that you want to achieve that day. It's the simplest little thing, and do that. But initially, it's a struggle. You forget, or you write it down, you don't do it, and then you don't do it, and then you hate yourself because I'm so disorganized or whatever. And we call that conscious incompetence. So you kind of moved up from level one to level two. You're now conscious of this inability, this struggle that you have, or this bad habit. But if you keep persevering, and this is the beauty of it, you pick the smallest little step. So the general answer to your question is you pick the smallest little step in the direction you want to go to build the particular virtue. And if it's orderliness, it could literally be, have a piece of paper where I write down the one thing that I need to do today, just that. But if you keep trying, eventually it'll become a habit and will no longer be a struggle. And then you can do, okay, I'm now going to do two or three things a day, and then I'm going to move on. And each time as it gets easier, it becomes a habit, you can layer on another piece and another piece. Eventually, maybe I'm time boxing where I list all the things I want to do today, and I allocate them to, in this hour I'm doing this, in that hour I'm doing that, and you become more and more orderly. And as that's happening, it's becoming easier, and you're enjoying it more. That's the key thing. When people think, it's just the way I'm kind of very creative and therefore disorganized, and it's just the way I am, that's a terrible loss because we are not fixed in these virtues. Every one of us can grow in any one of them. So then at some point you reach a third level, which is conscious competence, where every day I come up with a project list and I do things in order and so on. But it's still a bit of a struggle. I still have to keep reminding myself. And so you're still not at the level of virtue. Level four is the actual virtue, which we call unconscious competence. So now I do it without even thinking. Every day I got my plan for things to do for the day. I work through that plan each day. I pivot when I need to, and I'm not even thinking about it because it's now part of who I am. And I'm still as creative as I used to be, and I'm probably even more creative because when you have some order and structure, research shows us you can actually be more creative because you're not wasting as much time, you know. But those are the four stages that you go from not having a virtue at all, in fact, having the opposite, vice or bad habits, all the way up to a virtue.
So you're saying it takes a really deliberate focus on transferring from unconscious incompetent competence to eventually unconscious competence.
Exactly. It takes focus. It usually is preceded by some kind of aha moment where you realize, I need this. You know, I can't go on this way. I need this. But the good news is, because of the power of habit, you're not condemning yourself to a life of kind of, I need to keep kind of hunker down, bring my willpower to bear. Because by taking these sort of tiny steps, you take a little step, it becomes a habit. It's part of you. Take another little step, it becomes a habit. You're sort of building on a very solid foundation. And it's not like a big willpower sock, you know. That's the benefit of the habitual nature of virtues is they, in fact, when you have the virtue in its fullness, you're not really using much willpower.
Because it's a habit.
Because it's a habit. And then you can use your willpower for other things, you know.
How do you deal when you're trying on this process with backsliding?
You first of all have to forgive yourself, and not the worst thing is to treat it as kind of evidence that I can never do this, you know, because backsliding happens. You want daily practice to grow in a habit. There may be days when you forget, you know, but it's not like Duolingo on, you know, the language app where you've got a 90-day streak and then you miss a few days and your streak evaporates. It's not the way with habits. You practice. If you forget a day or forget 2 days, you backslide, you just start again. And you're typically starting again at a further, more advanced level than when you first began. So it's not something to be avoided, but not something to panic over.
And it's part of the process, right?
Well, I wouldn't say backsliding is part of the process. It may be or may not. You may actually get started and never backslide, or you may backslide and just get up and carry on, you know?
As you're talking, I'm thinking about the like Alcoholics Anonymous, where sometimes people fall off the wagon and they're not judged. They're just, okay, let's start again.
Yeah.
And in a vice, sometimes you think, well, vice is smoking or vice is promiscuity. That's not in particular what you're talking about, although those could be vices as bad habits that cause your life not to work well.
Yeah. So in fact, I actually don't use the word vice very much in the book at all, because I prefer to think of it more as kind of an absence of a virtue, just because the word vice is so loaded in the direction of mostly criminal things, you know?
Yes.
But if you think about, for example, the virtue of gratitude. So the vice, and people can't see me, but I'm doing air quotes, you know, is ingratitude. That it's a lack of the excellence of gratitude. And it has consequences. There's research that shows as people grow in gratitude, not only do they become happier, but they also become healthier, both mentally and physically. It's remarkable.
That's
your chronic pain, it is reduced as you grow in gratitude.
That's interesting. So you're saying that when we are able to find these virtues, and I guess all of us would have areas in our lives where we could use increased virtues. I certainly know I would, things that I could improve, that leads to a better mental state. Is that basically what you're saying?
It does. It's the analogy that I like. I got this from a high school teacher, the high school in Potomac, maybe you've heard of it, boys school. And he's also the coach of the boys, the climbing team. And he would tell me that when, after he took a new crop of boys out climbing, the next day they would come to him, invariably they would say, "Sir, muscles I didn't even know I had are killing me, you know, from the climbing."
Yes.
And the virtues, the super habits, are like mental muscles most people didn't even know they had. Because in a sense, we all have the capacity for any of the virtues. It's just part of our being human. every one of us has the capacity to be courageous or to be disciplined or to be grateful and so on as habits. But like muscles that have never been used before or haven't been used much, they're atrophied or they're not very strong. But all it takes is practice. So once you start to practice any one of them, that muscle becomes stronger. And just in the same way that you feel healthier when the muscles in your body are toned well, you know, and in good shape, I think you feel better mentally, spiritually, when your mental muscles are all in shape, you know?
Yeah, and your ethical muscles, are you also talking about that?
Yeah, it's very interesting because so there is a huge literature called virtue ethics. It's all about, and it's really good stuff, but the one negative about it is it makes a lot of people think that virtues are just about ethics. Mm-hmm. But they are about all kinds of excellence. And in many cases, the ethical and the practical dimensions, in most cases, cannot be separated. So, for example, is it an ethical thing to be a grateful person? Of course, we'd like people to be grateful, right? Is it practical? Is it you get along better in life if you are a grateful person? Absolutely. People appreciate gratitude, you know? And it's the same for courage. It's the same for self-discipline. It's the same for orderliness. In every case, living according to a virtue is both the right thing to do, the ethical thing to do, and the practical thing to do. That's the beauty of virtue, is it doesn't have this false separation between ethics and pragmatism. You know what I'm saying? It brings the two together.
You wrote something that I found interesting, that we are the summation of our daily habits. That means what?
That I think I was quoting someone there. But in effect, the virtues make up our character. So when Martin Luther King Jr. was talking about we should be judged by the content of our character, the content of our character are the virtues that we have, right? And so kind of in a sense, who we are is a function of the virtues that we have. Now, we also have our personality that tends to be a lot more fixed. So things like introversion, extroversion, those are kind of hardwired into us. They're also part of who we are. Not really worth changing. And so when people talk about playing to your strengths, for example, that makes sense with respect to personality. But with respect to character, which is a very different thing, it's a collection of the virtues, the habits that you have. And there it's not a question of playing to your strengths. It's a question of find your biggest areas of weaknesses and fix them.
So if I have a good sense of humor, it just comes naturally. That isn't a virtue because it's just part of my personality. Or if I have a dry personality that doesn't yuck it up and make jokes and so forth, that's not what we're talking about. Let's say I'm Jay Leno or something like that, where I can yuck it up a lot versus somebody who's very dry. We both have to practice the virtues in order to make the best of our respective lives, which are going to be different based on our different aspects of our personalities and our physicality and that kind of thing.
Exactly. And some virtues would be harder for some people than for others, depending on their personality. So, for example, if I'm an introvert, it might be harder to make friends initially, say, you know, but friendliness or friendship is a virtue. And I, even though I'm an introvert, that's no excuse. I can still learn to be friendly. An extrovert might have been easier at first glance to grow in friendliness, but then may have more of a challenge in building deeper friendships, but is still called to that as well. So everybody has the ability to grow in all of the virtues, but we have sort of different starting points because of our personalities, maybe because of our upbringing, our culture, and so on.
All right, well, that brings us up because of our limited time. Let's get into some of the super habits. We can't get into all of them. They're certainly well laid out in the book, I would urge people, if they're interested in this issue, to get the book. One of them, and it seems to be the one you give prominence to, is humility. What do you mean by humility, and why is that important?
So the way I define humility in the book, and this is consistent with the scientific research, with the philosophical approach, and so on, it is not kind of debasing yourself, but it's having a right an accurate understanding of yourself and your abilities. So a sort of a clear-eyed view of what you're able to do. And so then every virtue tends to have vices in the opposite direction. So in the sense of too much, too little. So the virtue of humility is all about my accurate understanding of myself. If I have too inflated of a belief of my abilities or my worth and so on, then that's going to be an excess, and that's going to be the vice of pride, right? But then I could also do in the opposite direction, where I have a belief, too low of a belief of myself. And there isn't a specific word for that, but you might say, like, we say sometimes false humility, you know? And it's not that, so to be humble.
Or self-denigration.
Or self-denigration, exactly, yeah. To be humble doesn't mean to never take on a stretch challenge, you know? But it does say don't take on something that is so beyond your capacity that you're going to waste your time and other people's time too, and maybe waste resources and fall on your face. You know, it's just having an accurate read of what you are capable or could be capable of doing.
You have a chapter on a term I had never seen before called gentle firmness. Did you coin that term, and why is it important, I assume, to be both gentle and firm?
Yeah, so you're right. The reason you never saw it before is I did coin it because the Latin term is mansuetudo, and there is an English word mansuetude that no one has ever heard of either, so that didn't help. But the more common English term is meekness. But the problem with—
Is it meekness, humility, or are they different?
Very different, very different. So the technical meaning of meekness is to be gentle and firm at the same time. So to be strong— It's typically the virtue that you use for dealing with anger, your own anger. Mm. When you are angry, you neither want to kind of just repress that anger, because that's very unhealthy. That's one extreme. The other extreme is to just explode every time you're angry. That's also going to cause you problems with those around you. So the virtuous thing to do is to take the anger and channel it towards fixing the problem. And what that does is anger gives you a certain firmness in your determination, but you have to do it in a gentle way, not in a, I'm breaking everything around me because I'm so angry. But because when I say meekness, nobody thinks of it in terms of that, right? They just think of it as being a doormat, you know, or think of it as a sort of false humility. So I just made up the word gentle firmness, because when I say that, it's pretty clear what I mean by that, is be firm and gentle at the same time. And in terms of anger management, so growing in the virtue of gentle firmness is exactly what helps you address that.
We've already talked about orderliness. I was going to get into that. But how about courage? Does that mean you're not being afraid, or does that mean you know what is right and do it even if you are afraid?
It's very much the latter. So courage is not having no fear. Fear is an emotion. Emotions arise. That we don't really have any control over them. We shouldn't try to control them in terms of repressing them. And the same thing, the two extremes opposing courage is, so courage is all about our relationship with the emotion of fear. And if we have too much concern about fear, then that's the vice of cowardice, right? Where we collapse every time we're afraid of something. But if we have too little respect for fear, then you have the vice of foolhardiness, you know, where you're just, or recklessness, you know, where you're just, the fear should be a signal that there's something to pay attention to, but the fear shouldn't rule you. And so what you're doing with the virtue of courage is saying, okay, I recognize I feel afraid and I'm going to do it anyway. And that to some people may seem impossible because I'm afraid and therefore I can't do it. No, there's this space in between the experience of the emotion and then the decision about what to do about it. And growing in virtue in so many cases is about enlarging that space to make room for a decision. And the decision is, I may be afraid, I'm doing it anyway.
I can really relate to that. Just my own personal story. When I was in high school, I was an unconscious, incompetent person when it came to courage. I called myself a turtle because anytime somebody looked at me crosswise, I'd stick my head back in my shell. And then I actually intentionally went out to be in a play.
Huh.
And I got a small part in a school play. And I was terrified. In fact, I remember just before going on stage, I only had two lines, but I was terrified. And then when it was over, my life had changed because I had, I actually did very well on the play. I was so filled with adrenaline that my two lines became quite meaningful. And I had the attention of the entire cast plus the audience. And I was saying, good grief, where was this all my life? But it seems to me in going through your four steps that by trying out for that play, I took a conscious act, and at least with regard to courage, that became an act of, I still was kind of that way as a, you know, through high school, but it got better and better and better. So that by the time I ended my high school career, I was no longer cowardly. I was unconsciously competent because I did, I'm just thinking about this in memory, go through those steps of saying, okay, I'm scared about doing this. I'm going to do it. So I kept going out for plays. I started asking girls out on dates. And it really changed everything from that one experience of doing two lines in a play.
That is a great, it's a textbook example of what I'm talking about. You took a little step, felt like a big deal, but it's a little step. You did it, you built the next step, and think of how different your life would have been if you hadn't done that, right? Think of all you've accomplished now because of the courage that you built up, right?
Without that moment, which was an epiphany for me on the stage, I mean, a true epiphany, I would not have done the things I have done in my life. And actually, I've done more than I ever expected to. So I can see how that could work. So how does one, now I gave you a personal example where that worked for me. I didn't know about the super habits or the four steps. But how does one develop courage if one is afraid in their life?
So it's the same as every other virtue. You want to find something that is going to be a stretch, but only a very, very small stretch. So in the book, I point out how Aquinas, for each of the cardinal virtues, there are four biggest virtues, courage is one of them. There are a bunch of smaller, what are called allied virtues. So one of those for courage is the virtue of resilience, which is just focused on kind of mental challenges, for anxiety, depression, and so on. And so, for example, this I found this on a YouTube video, quite humorous. A guy who was trying to grow in resilience gave himself a challenge that for 60 days, he would ask somebody each day a question where he knew he'd be refused, where the answer would be no.
That's interesting.
Because for most of us to be told no, especially young people, shrivel up. Oh, my gosh, they said no. You know, a young man won't ask a woman out on a date without first checking through the back channels that she's going to make sure she's going to say yes before he asks, because God forbid she should say no, you know. But you find you do that every day and you get told no every day for a month or two, and then it doesn't hurt anymore, you know. And you've now built a basis of resilience, and you can add on to that and add on to that. And as you're growing in resilience or perseverance or the other virtues related to courage, you're steadily growing in courage itself.
Yeah, my next question was going to be, how is courage related to resilience?
So according to Aquinas, there are four allied virtues to courage. Two of them are for enduring problems or challenges, and two of them are for overcoming challenges. Because some challenges in our life, you know, we face up to them, they can be overcome, like the one you mentioned. But others, you may not be able to overcome ever. Something like maybe a chronic illness or a handicap, you know. You just have to live with it. You have to learn to live with it. And so for enduring challenges, he mentions resilience and perseverance. Resilience for mental challenges, perseverance for physical challenges like tiredness, injury, and so on. So I talk to my students about how the perseverance they learn on the football field, for example, getting clobbered, they can then use in other aspects of their lives. The two virtues for overcoming challenges are magnanimity and munificence. Aquinas is a very practical guy. He says magnanimity is the habit of using tremendous human energy, zeal, to tackle a big problem, and munificence is using tremendous amounts of money to tackle the problem. So your own money, it has to be. So those are the four. Those are the four. And you pick any one of them, and it's going to and grow in it. It's going to help you grow in courage itself.
It's interesting. So let's say perseverance. Somebody may go through their life healthy, and then in their 60s have a stroke or something, and suddenly have to develop the virtue of perseverance that they may not have had to confront before.
Yes. But if in younger days they had already been developing perseverance by, say, taking cold showers, for example, or if you can't stand a cold shower, do what I do, which is a cold finish, the last few seconds of a shower in the cold, you know, just because, just managing your eating habits or your exercise habits and so on, and just not letting physical pain always, or the absence of physical pain, be the rule in your life. You know, just being willing to tolerate some physical pain for a good reason.
You know, as the old song goes, girls just want to have fun. You see the purpose of enjoying yourself, oneself, and you use a Greek word to describe this super habit called, tell me if I'm pronouncing this correct, eutropilia?
Eutropilia, yes. Yeah.
Eutropilia, which you describe, there's no English word for it, and you say it's playing well. So this gets into the enjoyment of life, which sometimes people might think, well, virtuous lives are not fun and not enjoyable, and you're saying quite the contrary.
Quite the contrary in two ways. One is, I mentioned before, that as you grow in virtue, you actually get happier. Life gets easier, and you get happier. But then there's this specific virtue called eutropilia, the habit of playing well. It's the habit of having, knowing how and regularly practicing good leisure, you know, just taking time off to do things that you enjoy for their own sake. And I think it's really important, because too much of what we do is always for some other reason. You know, we read to improve our minds. We socialize in order to network. You know, we exercise in order to get stronger or to get healthier. There has to be some time, ideally every week, where you're doing something just because you love it. You know, just going for a walk, watching a good movie, having great conversation, only because you love it. The two extremes, the vices opposed to eutropilia, are one is being frivolous and just making fun at inappropriate times and places or all the time. We all know people like that, you know, just like somebody who for everything is a joke, you know, which is annoying, and that's not the virtue. But the other extreme is what Aquinas calls mirthlessness. Somebody who is unable to enjoy life. And that's just a very sad place to be. The importance of eutropilia, even though I'm saying it should be all about doing something you enjoy for its own sake, it actually has a very practical benefit. And this is very interesting. Aquinas points this out, and contemporary science confirms it. When we're physically tired, all we need to do is stop moving. Sit down, lie down, take a nap, and we rest. But when we're mentally tired, spiritually tired, how do you stop your brain from moving? You know, how do you stop your mind from ticking over? Sometimes the more stressed we are, the harder it is to do that. Even at night, we know our brains, in REM sleep, stuff is going on, we're having dreams, you know. So the only time when our brains are really at rest is when we're doing something that we love. Because our minds are purpose-seeking organs. And when there is no purpose other than just having fun, just enjoying this thing, then we can say that our mind is truly at rest and we're truly having kind of mental relaxation. That's why playing games with friends, you know, can be so relaxing, so long as we're doing it for the joy of the game, you know, for the fun of it, not win at all costs, because that would sort of defeat the whole purpose, you know.
Or reading a good novel, or watching a good movie, or playing a round of golf, or
exactly.
Going out and playing basketball with your kid, that kind of thing.
All of these things, exactly. It has to be time. We have to make, eutropilia is the habit of making time for doing these things. So,
and how does the benefit you receive from doing that affect the other super habits?
So all the super habits seem to be connected in some way, that as we grow in one, we seem to grow in the others, even if we're not even trying. It's very interesting. And we see this with the, mentioned the app, we can talk more about it if you like. When we look at, people will work on one or two super habits through the app, but when we look at their scores over time, all the scores tend to rise. Not as much as the one you're focusing on, but other ones go up as well. We're not really sure the mechanics of that. Again, other than the fact that this is sort of the human design, and when we strengthen some of the muscles, it seems to strengthen the others as well, you know?
Oh, that's very interesting. You write about the importance of the spiritual life in the book. It isn't a major focus of the book, but you do write about it. What if one is a materialist and doesn't believe that the spiritual area exists in life or is important? Is there still a benefit to be attained through this kind of work?
Absolutely. In fact, some of the most the areas where the virtues are strongest right now are among the Stoics. There's sort of a resurgence of interest in Stoic philosophy. And they typically, I mean, the Stoics were pagans, you know. There's something fundamentally human about living the virtues. I think that having a spiritual perspective helps you overcome the problem of original sin, you know, because what you'll find as an atheist is that you can never become fully virtuous just on human strength alone. But it's certainly worth a try, and your life will get a lot better just from trying it, you know.
And I want to make it clear that what you just said is you're not saying you can't lead a moral life. That's not what you meant by virtue, because we've already discussed that.
That's exactly right. I'm talking about thriving, kind of reaching your fullest human potential. Yep, in every way, not just moral.
Well, we're running out of time, and I want to get into some of the other options people might have to access what you're talking about. You have a Substack that anyone can access. The link will be included in the program notes, by the way. Briefly, what can readers find if they subscribe to your Substack?
So what I try to do, and I write, is sort of just follow on stuff from the book, get into more detail on specific super habits, answer questions, talk about in particular domains in life. My wife sometimes writes as well more about super habits relevant to family life. And just sort of dig deeper as new science comes out, kind of share that as well. I'm starting to do more work on the role of super habits in corporations. So I'm writing about that as well. So that's all in the Substack, and it's a free Substack. There's no subscription cost. So,
and it's, you said it's interactive. So if people want to discuss over, you know, online with you through email or whatever it is, perhaps an issue they're having with their attempt to go into a proper unconscious competence. You're there to talk to people.
Yeah, if they want to comment, I'm also on LinkedIn, Dean Abella, yep, on LinkedIn, and they can.
And that will be in the notes too, by the way, the links.
Great, and they can message me there if they want to, you know.
And the app, you have an app that says Grow Virtue. That's downloadable, I assume, on Apple and on Android.
Yes.
And what can people find at the app?
So Grow Virtue, one word. It does two things. It does a diagnostic, so you can see how you're doing on all the different virtues. And then it has AI enabled. It helps you choose the thing you want to do. Once you decide, I want to grow in this, such and such a virtue or super habit, it helps you choose a daily practice and then gives you daily reminders. And then you can reassess after a while. And it just, the whole thing is designed to facilitate people growing in the super habits.
That's an amazing interactive kind of approach. How did you come up with that?
That's a good question.
had a super habit.
Yeah, no, I had an investor approach me and say, you should develop an app for the super habit. He read the manuscript of the book before it came out, was very excited. And I said, well, if you'll fund it, well, I'll develop it. So he funded it. And my son is a graduate from Catholic University in computer science, had worked on two apps previously and was looking for his next thing. And so he runs this. He developed the whole thing. And he had experience working with AI before in apps. And so brought all of that. And yeah, we're really pleased with how it's working out.
So if I decided to download the app and I decide that I want to work on orderliness, then I can type that in terms of the app, and a program can come back to help me start on that. Is that right?
It'll make some suggestions about, we'll ask you a few questions, make a few suggestions about what to do, and then remind you every day and ask you if you did it. And then if, as you,
you mean, it nag me every day?
Will it nag you? No, it's pretty gentle. You can always shut off the notifications, but
Well, this has been very interesting, and I want to congratulate you on the book. And what next for Dr. Andrew Abella?
My focus now is working with companies because the app, the data in the app is private to each person using it. But what we do have access to is the aggregate across large numbers. So you might have everybody in a company, for example, using the app. We can then diagnose if there are particular super habits or virtues that the company is in need of that would help improve their performance. Because there's lots of research that suggests that, that improving employees' virtues will have significant business result impact. And so I'm focusing on that, which is sort of appropriate as a business dean, as you would imagine. So.
Well, that's very interesting. Dr. Bella, thank you very much for joining us, and I look forward to developing some more super habits.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.